Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Catherine Trebeck, Policy and Knowledge Lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, asks, what do we want from economic growth? And what sort of a society are we aiming for? This was recorded in front of a live audience in Glasgow as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 11th of March 2020.
Thank you, Carol, and thanks for everyone at GCPH for inviting me. Thank you so much for coming along too on a day that everyone's been told to start staying away from each other. So thank you for taking the risk. I want to start by this idea of well-being and the idea of a well-being economy alliance, a well-being economy, because everyone's talking about well-being at the moment, it seems. There's lots of attention to it. Governments are talking about it. Academics are talking about it. You can't do really a funding proposal without putting well-being in there. But it's becoming a fairly, I think, slippery term, which maybe is a sign of success. Okay. I feel like I need a little box here just to stand put. Maybe it's a sign of success that the term's rising up, the political agenda, the media agenda. But to me, there's so many different interpretations of it. And to me, it sort of is summed up by this idea of the two SCs of well-being. And I think a lot of the debate is stuck in the first one. And this is the survival and coping. This is downstream treatment. This is the fix, help people cope with what I'd say is a pretty inhumane economic system. And then there's the other SC, where the well-being economy agenda is firmly located. And this is system change. And I once wrote a blog a couple of years ago where I was complaining about too narrow a focus on subjective self-reported well-being. People, particularly down in London, say that this is the preeminent political goal. We just need to measure subjective self-reported well-being. And I wrote this fairly ranty blog saying, doing that is like turning the volume up on your headphones while a riot rages around you. And then Audi put out an ad that sums it up. And I wonder if I can get this to work. I want to play this ad to you. So let's see. This might be really loud, so get ready. So if he was asked on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you, as he has his feet warmers and his glass of champagne, he would probably say he's doing okay. And so the point is that we need to attend to the circumstances in which people live their lives. And that means it's time for a new economic system, because the one we've got is failing in too many senses. First of all, it's an economic system that is based on growth, that is pushing our planet way beyond what she can tolerate. And we're seeing that with louder and louder warnings from the scientists around the world, who are starting to point the finger with less and less subtlety at economic growth as a root cause of this. And so this latter headline here is from the Global Assessment on Biodiversity Loss, where they are not subtle at all, saying it is the pursuit of relentless economic growth that is pushing us towards a sixth mass extinction. And of course, on top of the scientific warnings, we've got young people coming out of their classrooms every Friday saying enough of the political recalcitrance. So it's an unsafe form of growth. But here in Scotland, of course, we're already seeing this. It's not just sort of around the world where this damage is happening. And we've got the Adaptation Scotland saying that we're already seeing the impacts of the planetary breakdown, climate breakdown on our buildings, on our agriculture, and our transport. But not more than that, people are starting to be killed by this. You know, it's having an effect on people's life expectancy. And this is calculations that Friends of the Earth did a few years ago, estimating that 2,500 people, excessive deaths because of the pollution on our streets. So it's having a real impact here in Scotland and around the world, this unsafe growth. And we're getting to the point where scientists are saying we're now in a new geological era that they're calling the Anthropocene, in the sense that it is human beings who are putting most pressure on the planet. Though some people are sort of taking a second look at this and saying, hang on a minute, it's not everyone. And they're saying maybe we should be calling that the Plutocene, because it is a very small section of the population that is doing most pressure to the planet. And this is some research done by my former colleagues at Oxfam heading into the Paris COP, actually, and they calculated, and this is crucially according to consumption-based emissions, they calculated that it's the top 10% of emitters by consumption, this is really crucial, who account for almost 50% of global CO2 emissions, whereas the poorest half of the world's population account for less than half. And so anyone who ever says it's just population control, show them this graph, which rather ironically is shaped like a champagne, an old-fashioned champagne glass. So remember that. So it's a very small percentage of people who are doing most pressure to the planet. But it's also an unevenly shared harvest. We've got an economic system that is doing too little to support those who struggle to get by every day, whether that's in a global perspective or just down the road. And it does so much to support those whose lives, who've got so much wealth that it's their money that makes more money for them, more money than we could make by earning a living by going out to the office every day or going out to work. And we get to the point where our economic measures that we use to assess how a society is doing do not sufficiently capture this. So GDP per capita, rising stock markets, house prices, etc., don't capture this, and yet people are starting to feel stressed and anxious, feeling that the rug from under their feet is being pulled apart. And so what's going on behind this, in the fact that people's living standards are not equating to what's going on in the macro economy? McKinsey just a few years ago calculated that in the US, 81% of people lived in an income bracket where incomes were declining or stagnant in the last 10 years. In the UK, that figure is 70%. In Italy, it was 97%. So huge, vast, you know, majority of the population are seeing their income levels flatlining or going down. And in Scotland as well, we can't sit back, and you'll know this, I think, more than any other audience I talk to, we can't sit back and kid ourselves that things are going okay. We've, of course, got huge level of inequality of wealth, where the top 1% in Scotland have more wealth than the poorest half of the population. We're seeing so many people still in poverty, rising levels of in-work poverty, where people are working for their poverty, rising levels of suicide, and of course, we're now a country of food banks. And turning to that top figure, you know, what is going on here? This is an economic system that is designed in a way where those who've got wealth get returns for that in the form of rents that make them wealthier. And this chap who goes around the world selling his get-rich-quick schemes, and he thinks this is a good thing, that the poor and the middle class work for their money, the rich have their money make money for them. And that's the economic system that we've got at the moment, designed in this way. Laurie McFarlane, our colleague at Open Democracy, has calculated that since 1995, 3/4 of all wealth has been accumulated because of house price rises and rents. So it's a rentier economy, where if you're lucky enough to be standing on a pile of wealth, you're going to just carry on rising upwards. But the rest of us who are not are going to struggle to get by on flatlining incomes. So we've got an unsafe, unevenly shared economic system, but it's also an economic system that is doing so much damage to us and hurting us as individuals and as communities. We're seeing rising levels of loneliness, rising levels of sense of precariousness, time poverty, people feeling they don't have control over their lives, people having to work 3 jobs, you know, stress, anxiety, and all that comes with that. And again, this audience knows better than most how that translates into communities and into families and into lives and life expectancy. And so if we look around the world, and we're standing here at the beginning of the third decade of the millennium, we can say, yeah, there has been progress. You know, things have got better. We can all point to our favourite example of progress that's been achieved over the last few decades or even last few centuries. whether it's things like mothers and babies now surviving childbirth, you know, certain diseases being eradicated. Across the world, there are places where life expectancy is rising, literacy rates are falling, and so on. You all could identify your favorite example of progress along these lines. But the key thing is to remember that they have been achieved when the fruits of economic growth have been used to invest in our collective institutions, our health and our education systems, and when they've been pro-poor, designed deliberately to benefit those who need them most, rather than being sitting back and seeing that wealth being siphoned upwards to the very richest. And so what's happening now is that we need to take stock and say, okay, because it's now unsafe, unevenly shared, and hurting us, we need to take stock and ask, maybe growth-based economies are losing their relevance. Well, sadly, not yet amongst politicians, because we see this sort of fairly blinkered holding on to GDP and a growth-based economy as the only way to deliver for communities and for citizens. And so Savid Javid, just before he resigned, was saying we want to boost growth to almost 3% a year. This rather charming quote from the head of the UK diplomatic service at the time, said, human rights are not our top priority. Prosperity is further up the agenda. Crikey. You know, Trump saying, you know, by deregulating and lowering taxes, supporting free market, the soaring Trump economy is here to stay. Even our friends in New Zealand, who are, you know, you'd think of as really supporting this readiness to look at a different economic system, are still linking a lot of their policies to faster GDP growth. You know, so Grant Robertson, their finance minister, saying we're going to invest in this big infrastructure program to prepare for climate change, which is great, but that's downstream dealing with it. I'll come back to that. And helping to grow the economy. And even here, Kate Forbes in her recent budget, which was touted as a wellbeing budget, I'm not quite sure why, but it was saying we must also build a wellbeing economy which values growth but strives to be inclusive. So it's growth first, and then we'll try and be inclusive and fair. And I can't not tell you about the Australian Prime Minister, the wonderful ScoMo, who's, and this is during the height of the fires this last summer, who are saying we won't engage in reckless job destroying and economy crunching targets. And this is what one of the Australian cartoonists replied with, which I think sums up the predicament perfectly. We are so stuck in our collective imaginations that we cannot imagine an economy that is better than growth, that recognises that growth may have done its job, but now we're entering a terrain where it's unsafe, unevenly shared, and hurting us. And so what we need to do is shift our thinking and be fair weather friends rather than, as we currently are, the ever faithful followers. I mean, growth has become this sort of almost a faith for folks that, you know, this is the only way to deliver good lives, is to just grow the economy faster and faster. But we need to take a second look at it and be much more skeptical. Yes, be fair weather friends to growth. So when growth is necessary, there are parts of Scotland that absolutely need more growth. But it's got to be good quality job. It's got to be good quality growth. And it's got to be growth that's delivered in a way that doesn't put this excessive pressure on our planet. And so there are a couple of reasons why we've got to embark in this rather challenging conversation of thinking about a different economic system, not just tweaking around the edges. And partly it's because we're entering a stage in GDP-rich countries like the UK where growth is entering the stage of diminishing marginal returns. Now, any of you who studied economics would be familiar with this term. It's fairly intuitive. Essentially, you get fairly quick returns on something at early when you're starting to embark and enjoy it. You know, and salt is a good example. If you don't have any salt in your diet, you're quite sick. You need a little bit of salt. But very quickly, you get diminishing marginal returns from the benefit of that salt, so that you start to get less bang for your buck. And so it is with growth. And there's a couple of different ways of looking at this. This is work done calculating something called the genuine progress indicator. And that essentially takes GDP and corrects it for all the good things and all the bad things. So it takes out things like inequality or commuting or defensive expenditure like bottled water, and it adds in good things like volunteering or access to green space. And you can see that in the post-war era, this era of, you know, so-called the golden age of capitalism, when there are policies enacted to make sure growth was inclusive and progressive taxation systems and so on, you saw GDP per capita and genuine progress rise fairly consistently together. But after, and it's 1978, and we can have a conversation later about what happened in 1978, that caused the two to start to diverge and get wider and wider as genuine progress flatlined and GDP per capita just merrily carried on rising upwards. This is a recent entrant onto the social progress scene, sorry, the beyond GDP scene. This is the Social Progress Index. And these are colleagues of ours at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance who have taken 53 different dimensions of social progress, things like life expectancy, poverty reduction, literacy, all sorts of good things. And you can look it up. Their website's amazing, with lots of amazing data that you can play around with and crunch. And you can, what they've done is charted social progress on the y-axis. Along the x-axis is GDP per capita of various countries. And you can see here, I think, early stages of economic development, more GDP per capita makes a difference in terms of social progress. But very soon, the benefits start to tail off. And the risk is that if we keep pushing more and more, we're going to enter this stage, and Scottish audiences will be more familiar with this than most, of failure demand, this concept from social policy and management literature, where if you've got more demand for something, that's not necessarily a good thing. Whether it's top-up wages for those who are working for their poverty, whether it's housing benefits because the housing market is so skewed away from providing shelter for those who really need it, whether it's the 5 million people employed in the US in guard labour because we're scared of each other, or whether it's face masks on our streets because we're not keeping our streets clean. We see just layers and layers and layers of expenditure in what could be called failure demand because we have failed to deliver good lives for people first time around. And so what we're doing is stuck in this terrain of defensive, downstream, reactive spending that we could have avoided if we'd created an economy that met people's needs from the beginning. And environmental economists have their own equivalent. They talk about defensive expenditure. And nowhere has this been made more stark to me than in the recent fires in Australia. There was another big bushfire season, not nearly as big as the most recent one, because it is unprecedented, no matter what Rupert Murdoch will tell you. But back in 2009, there was Black Friday, happened in February. And 173 people were killed by the Australian bushfires then. GDP went up by $4 billion because of rebuilding homes, the overtime for emergency services, workers, insurance costs, and so on. So GDP would have recorded a bleak period in Australia's history as good for growth. And this is the terrain we're in. We've got these measures, these fundamentals, as you saw on the cartoon earlier, that cannot capture what really matters to people's lives. And then the other, I love this cartoon, you've probably all seen this, but this is where we are stuck. This territory of patting ourselves on the back for redistributing a little bit, rather than stopping to ask, how has that gap between rich and poor opened up so much in the first place? We're patting ourselves on the back for this sort of downstream mitigation, amelioration, and we're not doing a very good job at that. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But then we tally this up, this downstream stuff, and we call it success in terms of GDP. And in terms of this idea of pseudo-satisfiers, it comes from one of my favourite economists, Manfred Max Neef, who sadly died last year. But he talks about how across the world, we all have fairly similar fundamental human needs that make us innately human. But so often, we're reaching for something to satisfy those human needs that is a pseudo-satisfier. And so in the macro economy, we need decent jobs, decent quality of living, a safe natural environment. And we're reaching more and more for GDP to provide that. But it's also the same in sort of our individual terms. You know, we think about our fundamental need for social affiliation. We reach for more consumer goods. Coke will tell us our need for friendship is just as easy and as opening another bottle of Coke. This fundamental need of belonging. And see, the challenge is that the advertisers are pouncing onto this because this fundamental need for belonging is now Ray-Ban telling us just buy more sunglasses. And so we're doing the same thing in the macro economy. We of course need to deliver good lives for people, decent standard of living, secure economic footing under their feet, but reaching for GDP as a growth solution to all of that when we know that it's being siphoned up by those who have most, when we know it's doing such dangerous pressure on the environment, is no longer okay. And this is, to me, the most starkest example of pseudo-satisfies you can imagine, where people's needs for shelter and security is being met by giving homeless people stab-proof sleeping bags. And we pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, isn't this a great enterprise? You know, this is the terrain we are in. We get dazzled by initiatives like this rather than saying, hang on, these folks need a home and a secure, decent form of employment. And people around the world are starting to recognize that we just cannot carry on with this downstream tweaking, trying to polish a little bit, if we're lucky, to this economic system that is doing so much damage to people and planet. And so the Edelman survey has reported just a couple of weeks ago that the majority of people living in the rich world saying that they won't be better off in 5 years' time. Over half the world believes now that capitalism is doing more harm than good. And there's this growing sense, this inequity and unfairness is partly because institutions are no longer serving the interests of everyone. They're just serving the very few. And the UN itself is getting its head around this. And this is from the very recently published UN Human Development Report. And they said, yeah, we should recognize there has been progress. As I was saying earlier, there has been success. When growth is used well, we should recognize that. Things have come on remarkably. But the UN then says we should be careful about continuing those policies just because they cause that. In Iceland, they talk about success-induced bias, just assuming that what worked on before will carry on merrily in the future. We need to stop and look at all the danger signs that are meaning that we cannot just keep carrying on with this current economic system. And we need to open up our imaginations to a different system. And this is work done by our friends of ours down at the University of Leeds. And this is in a way, to me, the baseline chart we need to get our heads around, because they looked around the world for an economic system that lifted, on average, this key to qualifier there, but lifted on average its citizens above a social foundation, but without putting undue pressure on the planet, on our life support systems of the natural world. And the bad news is they couldn't find one economy that could deliver on both fronts. There's this big blank space in the top corner where economies that were socially just and sustainable should be. And so this is the message that tells us we need to imagine different economic systems. We need to restructure, not just tweak around the edges. And it's time to recognize, as we say in the book, that actually GDP-rich countries have arrived. They have got enough wealth and resources. What they now need to do is get so much better than they currently are at sharing and cherishing them. And that is a job that's about making ourselves at home. That's about building what we describe as a well-being economy. Okay, so that's been all really gloomy. You know, I want to know what a well-being economy is if it's not ninjas fighting each other in Tokyo in front of an Audi car. So a well-being economy for us, you don't really need to look far to see what it's about. Here's Manfred Max Neef, my favorite economist. If you turn the pages of great scholarship such as Manfred Max Neef or Martha Nussbaum or Amartya Sen, you start to see the sense of what the real purpose of development should be about. You also see it if you look at the brain scans of neuroscientists when they tell us what makes us stressed, what makes us anxious, when the stress hormone cortisol is rushing through our veins, when we're more content. I'd say more importantly, perhaps, you hear it loud and clear in deliberative conversations around the world, whether it's in Delhi or in Brazil or just over the river in Govan, about what really, really matters to people. When you give people a chance to stop and reflect on what most matters to them, you hear very, very similar things. I'm going to be a bit risque and try to play you another video now, because this is a lovely video created by my colleagues in Oxfam a few years ago. And this is this beautiful exercise with kids sharing their biscuits.
Cookies. I got cookies. I have a frustration in you, Raquel.
Not one. Got one. cut that one in half.
What one?
This one made that one.
Yeah, that's fair. Yay!
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. But you get the point in the sense that there's this innate sense of fairness that all of us are born with, and then the economic system does its very best to knock that out of us. But we do have fundamental needs and common values. And so at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, we asked all our members about what really matters to them, and they, of course, have drawn their mission from all their consultation with their members. And we pulled it together in what we call 5 we all needs. And I want to share them with you because this is what the economy needs to focus on. And so it's about the, we all have this need for connection. We all have the need for participation and having a sense of agency. We all have a need for nature, but also we need to ensure that we generate and protect the precious natural world. It's all about fairness and justice in all its dimensions. And of course, a sense of dignity, ensuring that everybody has enough. And for us, these are the core elements of what needs to define and be the very purpose of our economic system. And so getting there, building an economy in service of those needs, well, it's a hell of a challenge because, as I was saying earlier, it's not good enough just to bolt on a few little tweaks and mildly sort of humanise this rather inhumane, unfair, unequal, unsustainable economic system. And we need to wrap our heads around change at every single level of the system, whether it's a micro sort of individual initiative, business level projects, whether it's a policy level regime, but it's also a conversation about what is the very purpose of the economic system. Because if we change the goals at the very top, change in terms of policy and in terms of practice will be a lot easier. So we need to set new goals. We need to budge GDP off its perch. And actually, I was confessing the other day, I feel a bit sorry for GDP. It has been stretched way beyond what it was ever intended to do. It's become sort of we're conflated with our ideas of national success, which it was never, ever designed to do. So we need to budge GDP off and get our heads around designing the economy that's purposed in a way that delivers human and ecological well-being. And then we need to think about, rather than waiting till 5 o'clock in the afternoon and celebrate a tiny bit of redistribution or a bit of downstream amelioration, that sticking plaster, patching up, coping, resilience agenda, we need to ask the economy to do much more of the heavy lifting in delivering good lives for people. And this is about, rather ugly term, but I think the most awesome concept of pre-distribution. This is about sharing wealth creation better, having workers owning the firms, ensuring that it's not just owners of capital that benefit from economic activity, the foundational economy or community wealth building agenda that's getting a bit of traction here in Scotland, full cost accounting. So we're no longer seeing these false prices about the cost of flights anywhere or cost of pineapples, but we actually understand the real impact in the environment, but also in terms of social policy and in terms of how we, you know, employ people, the benefit of more people being employed, and yet we currently have a tax system that incentivizes away from employing more people. And there's lots in that, and we've got a table on our website called Old Way, New Way, where we start to set out across a wide range of different areas of life what getting it right first time round actually entails. So moving from celebrating this sort of social democratic consensus of amelioration and actually saying we need to fundamentally transform the economy. And so have a look on the website. I want to pick out just a couple of these different to give you a sense of what a wellbeing economy agenda really entails. And so in terms of homes and housing, the current way we've got fairly uninsulated, energy efficient homes, they're mostly rationed by price. And I'd say perhaps worse, users in investment vehicles. Last week, the Chartered Institute of Housing had their conference and they called it From Houses to Homes. And I was thinking, you know, no one talks about home price rises, do they? But we talk about house price rises when, you know, how's our investment going? You know, are we going to get more rent from that? So we need to shift from that mindset to sustainable design, embrace much more co-housing and think about more publicly and community-owned housing. In terms of work, in work poverty, we've got people, so much of that failure demand in just topping up people's wages at the moment and calling that a success. We've got huge, huge gaps between the rich and poorest in Scotland and in the UK. We've got this push to specialisation and automation, and don't get me started on the productivity agenda that seems to be so popular in Scotland at the moment. And even worse, we've got workers who are treated as just-in-time inventory, you know, on demand when we just click our app, rather than human beings and family members and community members. And so there's a pressure to just reduce the cost of labour rather than celebrate the potentially really important role of decent work in society building. And so doing things differently would be actually the radical idea of treating workers as human beings. Oh, sorry. Recognising that jobs are such a source of meeting our sort of collective fulfilment and meeting our fundamental human needs. And that's things like how we design the job so people have autonomy over their tasks, so they've got scope to follow through rather than just doing one tiny bit of something on the production chain, but they actually see where that work is going. Sharing work much better than we currently do, shorter working weeks or increased levels of holiday, whatever it takes so that we don't have these extremes that we're currently suffering. Workers owning the business, this is a territory of pre-distribution, so they own the value that they create rather than having it siphoned off upwards. And wages better reflecting the social value and having a much lower ratio between the richest and the poorest. In the workplace, in terms of mental health, we so often see this resilience agenda. Did you know, I was told this, if anyone speaks Scots Gaelic, you could correct me, but a friend of mine who's from South Uist says that in Scots Gaelic, they use the same word for resilience that they use for long suffering. I think that tells us all we need to know about the resilience agenda. And so what we have now is, you know, people told to toughen up, essentially learn to hold their breath longer rather than look at the foot that is keeping their head underwater. So we need to massively move away from people being treated as just-in-time inventory and this huge, fierce hierarchy of overwork and all the damage that that does to families. And so the new way in a wellbeing economy, we'll see jobs designed much differently, we'll see task rotation, and we'll have just this, at its most basic, sufficient and decent sources of income. And enough hours. Many years ago when we asked people what really mattered to them in Scotland, they said they wanted sufficiency of income, security of income. They didn't want crazy salaries. So a wellbeing economy starts to attend to that. And finally, and there's about 20 different aspects of this on the website, but finally it's about shifting our mindsets. Rather than, you know, being content just to stick a nice adjective in front of growth, because our imaginations are so stuck in seeing a growth-based economy as the only option, that we say, well, we'll just make it sustainable, or we'll just make it inclusive, or we'll just make it low carbon, or organic, or low fat, or whatever. But we're so stuck that the best we can do is put a nice adjective in front of it. We need to open up our imaginations to the possibility that we can have an economy that is better than growth, where growth is in service rather than the be-all and end-all. And so that is about recognising that actually, and we see this at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance every day, there are thousands of alternatives around the world. There are amazing businesses that are rolling up their sleeves and doing this so much better. They're putting purpose at the forefront of their economic activity. We can design things differently. It was 36 men that came together in 1947 in Mont Pelerin to design what became the current economic system. This is about politics rather than inevitability. And we need to reclaim this idea that the economy serves us rather than the other way around. And so, as I've hinted, there is loads happening on. These are the chinks of light that show us this is not a step into the unknown. But what we need to do is start joining up all this good practice. And so it's about the businesses that are saying, yes, so we're going to be economically viable, commercially successful, but whether it's Arup with their purposeful employment or all the cooperatives, or whether it's the Dutch with their better work-life balance, or the Danes who don't work Fridays. But it's essentially saying that, you know, economic activity doesn't need to be at the cost of humanity. It's this, you know, recognising that we've got to design businesses in a way that are in service of the environment. So this is Edinburgh Remakery, that is in service of remaking and repairing. And it's cities that are designed not like going through the duty-free section at most airports where you just have to go shop past shop after shop, but having cities designed for communities and for choirs rather than consumption. And again, there are loads of examples in the environment sense, the collaborative and circular economy, whether it's sharing books or cars or housing in the sort of co-housing sector, or my very favourite example that's been going on up in Islay for ages, where the waste heat from the Bowmore distillery is used to heat the local community swimming pool. Just this sort of really basic circular economy principles. So there's loads happening. And of course, as Carol's already mentioned, there is pioneering politicians out there who are saying, we don't have all the answers, but we recognize in the era of the Sustainable Development Goals, in an era of environmental breakdown and unprecedented levels of inequality, we need to do things differently. We can't rely on those same recipes that may have served us well in the past, as the UN tells us. And so WeGo is a partnership of, this is my rather grainy photo because I was trying to subtly take a photo through the corner of my elbow, so apologies for this. But this is the First Minister, it's the Prime Minister of Iceland, Katrin Jakob's daughter, and Carrie Exton, who's an amazing employee of the OECD. And this is the first policy lab of New Zealand, Scotland and Iceland, where civil servants, I hope you were there, Carol, weren't you? Civil servants came together as a bit of a therapy session, I guess, to share and exchange and support each other, putting wellbeing economy principles at the heart of government policy making. And at that lab, the First Minister said, you know, we recognise that GDP has become to be seen as a country's measure of success, but there's a growing realisation that we need to give much greater priority to quality of life. So little chinks are starting to prise open. We need to hold on to them and open them much wider. And the only way we will get there is by harnessing moments of change where people wake up to the enormity of the task in front of us and recognise that we cannot keep tweaking the system. And I was reflecting back of when there has been a big shift in public realisation. And we in the UK, people used to talk about the migrant crisis, and there were loads of statistics coming out from refugee agencies telling us about the stories of migrants who are putting their families in great danger to try and flee from oppressive systems. And it didn't make one bit of difference to the public until this little boy, Aylan Kurdi, was washed up on the beach. And in social media, people then started talking about refugees rather than migrants. And we saw a shift in pressure around the family reunion policies. And for a time there, the UK had fairly a bit of a step towards a humane refugee policy. And then, of course, in environmental terms, we were happily throwing away our plastic straws and our plastic bags and our plastic toothpaste until what people are talking about is the David Attenborough moment. And we've still got a long way to go on both counts, absolutely. But people have woken up, and now we no longer get plastic straws in Scotland. We've got plastic bags, and things are starting to change. We've got the circular economy agenda in Scotland really ramping up speed, which is just brilliant. This is the image that came out of the Australian bushfires that I'm about to show you that I hope is the one that turns our attention around and our political leaders so that people like ScoMo come to the COP and say, see how we were behaving in Madrid and how we blocked any progress on a climate deal. We recognise that we now need to understand climate justice and social justice as being two sides of the same coin, and we need to transform our economic systems. And this is the image that I hope wakes everyone up. This is little 7-year-old Flynn Burns, who this is taken at midday when the whole town of Mallacoota had to evacuate to the beach because of the fires coming, and the Australian Navy went in to rescue them. No longer can we be content in the face of these sorts of images just to tweak and polish and be content with downstream amelioration. What we need to do is embrace the urgent need to build a wellbeing economy. Thank you so much.